All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And good afternoon, good day, depending upon where you are in this wonderful world of ours. Welcome to Veterans Radio, coming to you live, that's right, live right here on Talk Radio, WAAM 1600, located in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. Today, boy, folks, do we have a program. I'm still trying to figure the whole darn thing out. What's going on in Syria? What's going on in China? What's going on in Russia? What's going on in North Korea? What's going on in Yemen? Yumpin' Yemeni, boy. We've got somebody, though, with us today, our frequent guest, Dr. Rebecca Grant. I shouldn't say our most popular, at least to me she is, but I got it. She's one of our popular guests coming on, and she will be able to set all this stuff straight. Whew, I can't wait to get started on that. But we got a couple things to do. First of all, there is a Golden Age game, so I want to keep reminding all you veterans, sports guys, it's for age 50 and over, the Golden Age Games. You must be a patient at the VA. No, you don't have to be inpatient. Of course not. But receiving care at the VA in order to qualify is going to be in Detroit from the 10th to the 14th of July of this year. And they have everything from badminton to cycling to discus throwing to javelin, etc., etc. You're going to want to go to va.gov and you're going to want to put in your search on there, the Golden Games, Golden Age Games in Detroit, Michigan in July. We'll be telling you more about this. We're going to be down there. That's right. We're going to be doing this. And there's going to be another Pets for Vets, a public adoption event and fundraiser. That's going to be held at February 27th for about 5 hours, 10 until 3. It's going to be at the Wayne Ford Civic Center on North Wayne Road. And it's going to be all kinds. It's free, by the way. There's going to be dogs and cats and gerbils and everything else. Pets for Vets, we're going to be matching people up. We're going to be talking about, while we're there, we're going to be talking about the importance of health, mental health for our veterans, and pets have a lot to do with that. So it's Pets for Vets, Saturday, February the 27th, Wayne Ford Civic League in Wayne, Michigan on Wayne Road. That's a free event, of course. That should be very, very, very cool. And there's one other item kind of dovetails into what we had last week. We honored the 12th anniversary of the death of specialist Holly McGo. And she was in harm's way, folks. she was right there. She was in combat and the knuckle draggers way back. And, oh, man, women don't belong in combat. They freeze up. Oh, really? No, tell that to her mother. Well, things are changing now. Yes, the generals, the top generals in the Marine and Army Corps are saying now that women should register for the draft. That's right. And they're asking Congress to draft up specific legislation to make that change. There's hearings being held, but you know what? It really makes me kind of laugh because, we don't want them in combat, huh? Right. Tell that to the kids that are out there, the men and the women both, that are defending our freedoms and that are our spear point in the world and our spear point in the war on terrorism. We got a lot to talk about the war on terrorism, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Islamic State and all that other business. So don't you go away because you're going to want to have your paper and pencil handy. You're going to want to write this stuff down so you can talk to that neighbor or whomever and start spouting off about, well, we're not military ready. Oh, is that right? Oh, I don't seem to see that. Not in all the research I do or the guests that we have on this program. Sounds to me like somebody's scrambling around. We'll be right back with Dr. Rebecca Grant, straight to you from D.C. That's Washington, D.C., right after this very important message. So don't you go away. All right, we're back to you on Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. With me right now is Dr. Rebecca L. Grant, and she is a contributing editor for Air Force Magazine. She was the director of the General Billy Mitchell Institute for Air Power Studies. Wow. She's also senior fellow at Lexington Institute. We'll have to ask about that. She got her PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics and has worked for RAND, R-A-N-D, and the United States Air Force. 1995, Dr. Grant founded IRIS, which is Independent Research. That's right. She founded that, and she has been doing research now, and sort of the think tank for the Air Force. In 2012, Dr. Grant spoke out on hypoxia issues of the Lockheed Martin F-22 Raptor. Ooh, we'll probably even have to ask about that. Experienced pilots don't know anything. Wow, you know, we talk about that, but those guys now and gals that are flying the drones, I wonder if they don't have any hypoxia issues, right? They're all in Morocco liners. But anyway, direct from Washington, D.C., on the line with us today and to share a lot of information, Dr. Rebecca Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be back on Veterans Radio.
Well, it's great to have you, and welcome 2016. The best of you and your family and the health for the coming year.
And same to you for 2016, and will it be a very interesting year in international politics and military affairs? Yes, I think it will.
I can't take it. I just can't take it. Whoa, man. Well, the good way to start is, first of all, let's get a little piece of news. The A-10 Warthog, what a name for an Air Force plane. Come on, guys. You know, Sabre, Jet, Warthog? The A-10, it was breathing its last. It was on life support. There's 12 of them at Selfridge Air Force Base, about 50 miles outside of Detroit. And, well, they've just been given a reprieve. The A-10 Warthog has just been given a reprieve. It's a crucial to our fight against Islamic extremists. Dr. Grant, tell us about that.
That's right, Bob. The A-10 is staying in the United States Air Force inventory for, at least the next 5 to 7 years. They're talking now about beginning some phased-out retirements after 2022, but that's pretty long ways off. The Air Force had tried to retire the A-10 because it is getting a little bit old, but Congress said not so fast. And what's really news here is that it's budget time in Washington, D.C., and this year's Air Force budget, following that direction, does keep the A-10s in the force for the next several years. So that is big news. That's a big decision on the part of the Air Force.
Yes, it is. And, of course, we're all happy around here. Selfridge Air Force Base is a big provider of jobs in this area, and it's good to hear that about the A-10. And it is crucial to the fight against Islamic extremists. Go into a little more detail. Why the A-10 in particular?
Right. Well, just when we thought that the lifespan of the A-10 was over, it has turned out to be very useful again. You have to remember there are a number of different type of aircraft engaged in those operations, and I want to talk a little bit later. After we talk about the A-10, I want to talk about just how busy the A-10 and the other aircraft are. But the A-10 has turned out to be a good platform for flying at a relatively slower speed, and the A-10 is just ferocious on the battlefield. If you've ever heard an A-10 launching its rockets or firing its 30-millimeter cannon, it is a sound like no other. It's a sound that really inspires fear and respect. And they've done a lot of work. So it's been a very, very active air war there over the past year. A-10's been a big part of that. And because it is what the Air Force calls permissive airspace, that means that they're not facing advanced surface-to-air missiles And, of course, there are no fighters opposing the A-10 at the moment. And because of that, the A-10 is able to operate really over that complete battle space. And I think we have to remember, too, how much forces on the ground, friendly forces, like the A-10. We do have some U.S. Advisors there. And, of course, we have, friendly ground forces in the area, and they love the A-10. So it's been the right choice for the conflict that's developed there, especially over the past year. Doing great work.
And you know what, folks? This is your U.S. government at work, saving us a few bucks, well, but not at the expense of our soldiers, sailors, Marines, and Air Force people. We've got experienced mechanics. We have parts. We have experienced pilots. We've got everything for the A-10. The government's doing it right, and the Air Force is doing it right. Congratulations, Dr. Grant. Congratulations to the Air Force. Syria! Oh, my gosh. How in the world can we figure out Syria? Here we go. Okay. Now there's peace talks. Oh, yes. And I did a little research on President Assad. I think he was a king at one time, or his father was a king, something like that. But anyway, when his father died, President Assad ascended to the throne, and, well, he wasn't really a nice guy. He put chemical weapons, that's right, he dropped sarin on his own population. Oh, nice guy. Who comes along and supports him? The Ruskies. What in the world are they doing? Oh, they've got nobody else to back. They back somebody that chemically attacks its own people. Dr. Grant, tell us all about what the heck is going on with Syria, Russia, and the U.S.
Well, when you put it that way, it does sound pretty bad, doesn't it? In fact, those chemical weapons are a little bit of a signature of old Soviet foreign policy. They put chemical weapons in a lot of different places, didn't use them, but certainly spread them around. And now it's become a bit of a signature for the Russians, too. Remember, we worried about chemical weapons in Saddam Hussein's Iraq 25 years ago when Operation Desert Storm was going on. We're in the 25th anniversary there. And that was a huge concern for then-President H.W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, who was very concerned about chemical weapons. So it's the same thing that we see with Syria. We know the Soviets and then the Russians did supply those weapons. And, of course, we know that Iraq used them at one point many, many years ago. And we have all sorts of reports about weapons being used in Syria. It's a little unclear who did what to whom. We may never know. But the larger question is, what a mess to sort out. And in the middle of it, here comes the Russian Air Force setting up shop at a lovely base in Syria. It's really very pleasant there. I can't blame them for wanting to be there. They fly around in the afternoons and generally make trouble and drop weapons that we would never even think about using. So what we have going on there to oppose this is what's become an incredibly active air war. If you look at the rate of flying, and both for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, so we collect information on the movement of adversary ground forces, and also at our own strike sorties, it's really, really, really gone up. I mean, we've just seen a lot of activity in Operation Inherent Resolve. So it's something we're very heavily engaged in. You don't always see it in the press. Sometimes the big things make the press, but it is, believe me, that is Air Force and our joint services and allies really, really quite heavily involved in trying to keep the lid on Syria.
Folks, here come the Russians. They're now backing Assad. We were going to have regime change, folks. That's right. There was a time after the dropping of the chemical weapons and using of chemical weapons, et cetera. We were going to have regime change. We were ready to do that. And this guy, he's got a second, third, and fourth life. So the rebels who came in, we supported the rebels. It was better than taking out Assad on our own. We let the rebels, we support. Now here come the Russians. Here come the Russians, folks. Now the Russians, are having airstrikes against the rebels whom we support for regime change on Saddam, who's a chowser anyway. And Dr. Grant, is there the possibility of the Air Force and Russia and some of our planes having contact? Is that even remote?
I'd say there's a remote possibility, and in fact, our air commanders there have taken care to work out the procedures so that we don't get too close. There were some somewhat closer calls back in the fall, but, you know, close can be 20, 30 miles. As we know, the Turkish Air Force shot down a Russian jet that had strayed into Turkish airspace. Didn't go very far in towards Turkey. There's a little dip in the border. But the Turks did shoot down that Russian jet because it had lots of warning. So I trust our U.S. airmen to stay out of the way of the Russians. And it's interesting, you know, in with the U.S., whether it's Air Force or our Navy or Marine Corps, they fly 24/7. They can fly a mission in the afternoon. They can fly at night. They train for that. What we've seen with the Russians is they really prefer to fly like at about 2 in the afternoon. So they don't fly quite as actively. That helps. But the pace of operations means that, you know, we do see aircraft there in proximity. I want to give you a couple numbers. When you look at the sorties that were flown, a sortie is when you, you know, fly out and come back and land counts as one sortie. Sorties with at least one release of weapons. In 2014, there were 2,003 sorties flown where at least one time a weapon was released. 2003. In 2015, that number went up to almost 10,000 sorties. It has gotten to the point where the Air Force has had to buy more bombs because we are running low on a few of the key stocks that they like to use. They're the smaller precision weapons. And so the pace of operations is just staggering. It's really, really, really gone up.
So, folks, the rebels, are they Sunni or Shia?
Well, you know, we have a mix here because we're talking about an Islamic State that spreads not only through Syria but through parts of Iraq. And when we it's possible you've got a mix in some cases here, whether you're dealing with the opposition that's in the territory of Iraq or the opposition's in the territory of Syria. It's really, really quite a mixed-up bag. And, you know, I think that's why we see at least some overtures towards a little bit more diplomacy coming in and the possibility of trying to talk this one through, because it's gotten to be a very difficult and intractable situation. We've done a lot of work to try to retake ground in Iraq, in the northern areas of Iraq, where the Islamic State was very powerful. But that's obviously harder to do in Syria.
Well, if we're looking at our involvement, we're using, as far as what I could find in my research, we're using drones, the Raptor, right? Correct, and we are using drones to selectively take out targets. There was a ISIS commander just recently that was eliminated, and well, I think I'd rather do that than have our troops to have boots on the ground. But it's so mind-boggling to think of Russia now being our surrogate, being being there and taking the fight. But yet we are still. But we're not doing airstrikes. We're doing these selected targets. Am I correct with that?
You know, we're doing some of all of the above. So in some cases, the targets that the Russians want to hit and the targets that we want to hit are the same. In some cases, they're not. You know, we don't see the Russian level of activity in the areas where the Islamic State is operating in what we would think of as Iraq. You know, ISIS really is sort of a blob that goes across the northern parts of Iraq and into parts of Syria. So Russia's focus is mainly in that Syrian region. We are focused in parts of Syria and also in parts of Iraq. Of course, these places in Iraq, a lot of them are where our forces during Operation Iraqi Freedom, our coalition forces, went and, you know, settled these areas down or freed them from Saddam Hussein and then settled them down. So there's, you know, a lot of feeling at stake here. About the aircraft, yes, you're right, we are using the Reaper unmanned aircraft or drones. Their role is surveillance, but they're also armored with Hellfire and other types of weapons. It usually takes more than just one aircraft to track a target and initiate a strike. They'll often have to watch an area for a long time to find that high-value individual or that key outpost. So you may have a drone watch it, then you may have some fighter jets come in, look around, and if they run out of fuel and need to go back to the tanker, you may have another set of fighters come in and carry out the strike in the end. So it's usually a team effort in developing these emerging targets.
Now, take us, we've got about 5 minutes before the halfway break. Take us to, what would I want to call this, an event, no, a mission, where somebody, is it somebody on the ground that calls in the Raptor? Is there, or how is that done? How, we've got the target, we know where the target is, who calls that in, and how does that guide it in? How is that strike carried out? Take us.
Yeah, that's a great question. It can happen in a couple of different ways. One is it can happen as we use the full motion video, say, from a Reaper platform. It's very crisp and precise, and it's possible to watch an area. If you have actionable intelligence that says important bad guy is going to be at this road intersection, you may have a drone orbit and watch that intersection. Then you see that Mercedes SUV pull up, right? And then a couple things have to happen. Let's assume you don't have any friendly ground forces anywhere nearby, and we keep close track of those positions. In that case, an aircraft can be called in directly by someone who is watching the sensor feed from an unmanned system, for example. And if we know that it's clear, then you've got a big area, you don't have any friendly forces. It's an area that, let's say, it's out in the countryside, so you're not worried about civilian casualties either. You can go ahead and call in that airstrike on that bad guy, on Mr. Bad Guy, in that Mercedes SUV. If it's another case where you're in an area where you've got civilian buildings, you're going to have to calculate what the potential for damage is there and factor that in. And let's say you have a special forces operative on the ground. They have the ability to call in airstrikes, and they can actually share a picture on a little handheld device called a rover. They can look at a picture of the target area and send that picture up to the fighter jet in the sky. They see the exact same picture, and they can say, hey, get that Mercedes SUV or target that the palm tree to the right. They can each see the same image and go ahead and release a precision weapon on that image.
You know what, folks? I call that to be pretty darn good military, if you ask me, and I was listening the other night, and I'm not even going to get into that kind of baloney. But so what we are doing, folks, is that, yes, we are looking to hold down collateral damage at a minimal, right? We don't want to be blowing up women and children, and that's where these punks and ISIS slime hide. They got cowards is what they are, folks. They're just true cowards. And they're hiding behind civilians and doing that. And so we have to be able to take that out selectively. We can't come in there and turn them into glass, man. Oh, I don't think that's going to happen. So we're one last, we've only got a couple minutes for the halfway point. And there was the Russians had some airstrikes the other day, and they took out a village that the rebels against President Assad had been holding, and it was a Shiite village. What does that mean, Dr. Grant?
Well, that means that village probably wasn't, it's hard to say about the specifics, but they probably weren't as careful with it as we might have been. So they've gone and taken out this village. They think that they've got elements of the rebel command there or whatnot, but it's probably done very differently from how we would have had to do it. We would have had to be very much more precise in making sure we have fewer civilian casualties. I don't see evidence that the Russians are as concerned about those things as we are.
We've got 2 minutes. The other point I was making out on that is, what does that do between relations for the Shia and the Sunnis?
Well, and that goes back a long way. You know, we obviously have an Iraqi government that's primarily Shia. It had been Sunni in the past. You know, what we want to see, certainly in the territory of ISIS, that is within Iraq, is we'd like to see these two sides get along, and of course the Kurds come into this as well. That's what we've tried to build in Iraq following the 2003 war, so that we would have enough representative democracy to heal over the religious rifts. Been successful in some ways and obviously not in others, and so it remains a big issue, and it also goes to the support of outside groups, Iran and others, who will support the Shia cause in many cases. So when you say, what's the right answer here, it's really tough to work through those religious lines, and very difficult with Assad there to see, what is the possible good outcome for Syria and for that entire region. Hard to say.
Okay, we're going to be right back right after the news in a very short break. And, I hear the band's getting up and they're getting ready to play a little music. Dr. Graham, please have yourself a cup of tea. Take a little break, a deep breath. We'll be right back. We're going to be talking about North Korea. Oh, Lord. China, Russia. Oh, here's a little quote. Recently, President Putin said Russia would continue to develop nuclear weapons but doesn't intend to use them. Gee, thanks, Putin. You will be right back. Back on Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAAM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And with me on the line is Dr. Rebecca Grant, straight from Washington, D.C. She's talking about the Air Force and their commitment to the security of this country and all of the fine weaponry that we have at our disposals to keep us safe and secure. But now, we've got North Korea, wouldn't you know, in the news. Talk about a segue. Now we're going to have sanctions of the whole world on the North Koreans launching rockets and rattling sabers. Well, we'll get to that in a second, but the first question I have to Dr. Grant, I got to ask this. The hydrogen bomb that was supposed, was that true or false by North Korea? Did they actually
blow one? Looks like
true.
Looks like true. You can tell from the level of concern, and at the UN, our ambassador Samantha Power has given some pretty strong language on that and on the recent rocket launch. So there were reports on January 6th of this year that North Korea had done an underground test up in their underground test facility. They've tested a few times over the past decade or so. This looked like it was a slightly larger test, maybe a weapon in about the 10 kiloton range. It's funny, they actually sort of follow the test ban treaty and testing underground, which is what is done these days. So hard to guess. I suspect one has, probably our intelligence folks are pretty good at figuring it out. So it looks like they did do a hydrogen bomb test of some sort.
So we now have another nuclear brother or sister in North Korea. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think we have to assume it is. We don't know for sure, but we have to assume yes, because if it turns out they don't have nuclear weapons, that would be great. But they certainly are acting like they do. They want us to think they do, and the reporting is strong enough. It's certainly plausible, and it's been going on for a while. So I think we have to assume that they have a rudimentary capability, a rudimentary nuclear capability. Yes, that's how it looks.
Now, they don't. Somebody had to give this to them. Somebody had to give the technology to them. If you don't want to touch on that, I can understand. But if you want to touch on possibility, let's put it that way. Where did this stuff come from? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we feel, and they may be sorry now, but we feel that China is their big ally. In fact, really sort of their only ally. Now, interestingly, China wants them to stop this nuclear nonsense. They condemn nuclear tests. They want dialogue. They want peaceful resolution. But, here's the thing with North Korea. They're not an easy problem for China either, because there's one scenario that really scares China, it scares South Korea, and it scares the West and us, the United States. And that is of a collapse of North Korea. China fears a surge of North Korean refugees across the border. Same thing with South Korea. And we wonder then how the U.S. would organize feeding and helping those refugees. So I think everybody wants to not see a collapse. What's scary, though, is when you combine this potential nuclear capability, this rudimentary nuclear capability, with the test that they did yesterday, Bob, of another long-range missile test, attempting to pop up another satellite there in orbit. And what we think they're doing is developing a missile called the Taipodong 2, which is reported to have a range that can reach the west coast of the U.S. Oh, boy. So if they get that working, that's a bit scary. The response to that has been for the U.S. and South Korea to really get serious about talks to deploy one of our best missile defense systems, which is called THAAD. It stands for Theater High Altitude Air Defense, and it's an endgame interceptor that's very good at intercepting an incoming missile. So we're talking now about whether to deploy THAAD to South Korea, given this turn of events.
So, as this, of course, this all came out about the rocket today, and I don't know what the range on that rocket is, but it certainly, with a nuclear capability in North Korea, that the North Koreans could be threatening Japan. They could even threaten China. They're, you know, you can't let the genie out and then try to put it all back in the bottle again. China, what were you doing messing around with Kim Jong-un? The guy is completely off his shoosie, and that just amazes me now. Oh yeah, well now we gotta control all this. Well, it ain't happening. In fact, what's also happening, here's China and Taiwan, folks, are making nice. Yeah, they hated each other for years and years. One was free China, the other was communist China. Oh, my goodness. Tell us about that, Dr. Grant.
Right, with Taiwan, it's such an interesting relationship, so close, so very much within the sphere. And, of course, China having taken back Hong Kong many, many years ago now and successfully integrated that. They do talk about, two systems within one nation and whatnot. But it's clear that, that shadow really looms over Taiwan. I think also interesting with China, as they flex their muscle on the world stage, North Korea, what a problematic state for them to deal with. Just like you said, they can't put that genie back in the bottle. But they're off stirring the pot a little further south, down in the South China Sea, with their land reclamation projects. And our Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, has really been on their case, saying, look, just because you pour some sand up over a coral reef and build an airstrip on it doesn't mean you've created sovereign territory. And yet that's exactly what they've done. So this little island, which is just some rocks called Fiery Cross, now has not only an airfield but a little taxiway. And the whole thing, they have taken what was once just blue ocean with a few dots of rock sticking up and made an airstrip. So that is part of their kind of ongoing plan to extend their military sphere of influence over these contested islands.
Now folks, you just have to, you got to understand this. They are creating islands out of reefs, artificial islands, and they're claiming them as sovereign territory, which has the 12-mile, I think it is, limit around, which all of a sudden you've got a little piece of the ocean that you didn't have before. What alternatives does the U.S. and its allies have to put a kibosh on this? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, this one's such a mess. And they've built it up. There are pictures all over the Internet. And this, first of all, where this is it's right, right between the Philippines and Vietnam. So a little bit south of Hainan Island, all the nations around there claim these little shoals, and of course there are a lot of minerals and all that around. But what the Chinese have put in is a nice little airstrip, a little lagoon for docking the ships and the things that, spew the sand in to create this, and some buildings. So they've really stuck this there. And what this means is if they, you know, it's just one long strip. It's not the best airfield in the world, but it's not bad. They want to send some fighters out there and patrol the area. They now have the ability to do that. It's incredible. They've done this just in the past year, built this little air base at Fiery Cross Reef. We haven't seen a big military deployment there, but we have spotted a few aircraft on the taxiway. So there we are. And what we're doing, you know, our Navy continues to sail close. The Chinese protest. But the key is this is the commons. There's a lot of world shipping that goes through here. A lot of nations claim this territory, and we don't need to have China saying, hey, you can't sail through here. So bless our Pacific Fleet. They are off in 7th Fleet there. They continue to send ships like destroyers and cruisers along there on their areas that they've sailed in for many, many years, and we're not backing down from that. So our U.S. Navy is out there making sure we are not backing down from these Chinese threats.
You know, it's interesting. I heard a comment on how, assuming that we were not military ready, that's such a joke. Anybody that says anything like that, wow. I mean, what do they got? Sushi for brains, if you ask me. We're back to North Korea again. Well, when we wanted to show a little muscle, we sent a B-52 over the Korean Peninsula as a demonstration of our U.S. commitment. And I think you've made that very clear by just bringing our Navy and having our Navy out there and our Air Force out there keeping watch over the whole area. And, oh, by the way, folks, North Korea is selling weapons in Africa. They're selling them to Africa. Do you got, Dr. Grant, can you comment on that? Do you have any intel on that?
I tell you, there are some interesting arms sales customers down in Africa, and you look at who they are sometimes, and it'll be Sudan and whatnot. So there is quite the arms trade. China does that as well. As we know, there's a lot of unrest in various parts of Africa, and there's always a demand for a few extra weapons and ammunition. But, you know, I have to really second what you said about our Navy out there conducting what they call freedom of navigation operations. Those young sailors are out there. No one's ever going to give them a medal for the work they're doing, for keeping a watch for us, but they are really doing important diplomatic work, not just for the United States, but really for the world at this point. So thank you to them for doing that. We'll continue to see, I think, this mischief from China and North Korea. So, you know, the most important thing we can do is to keep our forces ready. We want to deter. That's the point of all this. We want to deter and keep a balance so that none of this boils over.
And it is a balance, folks, a very delicate balance. We'll be right back right after this short PSA. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. And we're back on Veterans Radio with Dr. Rebecca Grant, spokesperson for the Air Force. Okay, what do we have now? Wow, we talked about China. We talked to North Korea, Syria, A-10, Russia. Goodness, goodness, goodness. What else do we have? Well, I've got something right here. The KC-46A Pegasus tanker. Now, I mean, this thing is a beautiful aircraft. I just love it. I'm looking at it right now. It's gorgeous. I mean, it's got some nice lines. But then I'm also thinking about the C-17 Globemaster, the 130 Hercules. We have all these transport vehicles, I guess you call them, planes, right? You know, what is this? We have three different modalities. Tell us about that, Dr. Grant.
Right, and they all fall under one great term called air mobility. So the KC-46 is the new tanker that's being built. It's just done a couple test flights. It's called the Pegasus. Boeing won this contract a few years ago to replace our older 707-based airframes. So it's based off a 767 airliner. And, of course, you know what a tanker does? It carries a lot of fuel. It drops a boom in order to refuel aircraft along the way. Those could be fighters carrying out missions, bombers as well. Some tankers can refuel each other. They can also refuel the big surveillance planes like the AWACS, and that's quite exciting to get two of those big aircraft close together. I had the privilege to fly in a B-2 bomber while it was doing refueling, and it's very, very interesting, just the ability to get them close together. I really admire our men and women who do that regularly. That's just
did you actually say women? Oh, my goodness. You mean women are in danger? Oh, my goodness. I don't believe that. Well, if we got a few minutes, we can talk about this a little bit at the end of the program. But no, these are men and women, folks.
That's right.
That's right. They're in harm's way, and they're out there doing their job. Got it? Got it. So I don't want to hear nothing from any of those politicians chirping around about, well, we're not prepared. Oh, we're really not prepared. Is that right? Well, while you were watching this refueling, how was your heartbeat? It must have been out of sight.
My heart beat pretty fast through that whole flight, I have to tell you, but I think the time it beat the fastest was during the refueling, as you see that tanker get closer and closer. But you know what's so neat about it is that the person who is running the whole show at that point is the boom operator. And that's generally, in the Air Force, that's a senior airman. This individual might be just in their early 20s, he or she. Women and men do this job. And they're the ones who take over and actually control the boom as it locks on to the aircraft that's being refueled. And then fuel goes down at a very, very fast rate, so they can accomplish this air refueling in just a few minutes.
Well,
you talk about women. They have flown in that whole air mobility force. Women fly the C-130s. They fly our C-17s, and that mobility force is a real unique strength of America. That's how we can deploy military forces quickly, and it's also how we can manage so many humanitarian relief operations. It's with those terrific mobility forces. They are spread out all over the globe at any moment of the day.
I did forget when the C-5A, That monster should also be included in this mobility force. Is that correct?
You bet. And the C-5s have actually been upgraded. They got some new engines, and boy, are they something else now. They received some new engines and other upgrades into a configuration called C-5M. And it is an enormous plane. Many are based up at Dover, Delaware, and so we just occasionally we'll see one either here in the D.C. area or driving off to the beach, and it's a sight you won't forget to see that in the air. Of course, all of our air mobility, so interesting, did you know, Bob, is controlled out of a center at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois, the Tanker Airlift Control Center. It operates 24/7, 365 days a year, and they know where all those mobility aircraft are all around the world.
What?
Fascinating.
That's the first I've ever heard of this. Where's this in? Illinois?
Yes.
I thought that's all they do is play basketball.
They're modest, but they have to deal with the weather, the logistics. You know, you may send a C-17 out to some base in Africa, and that C-17 commanded by a captain, you know, a young officer in their 20s, has to land, has to find fuel, has to carry out all this, and they are tremendous. They're tremendous warriors and tremendous ambassadors for the United States as well.
Well, I'm certainly impressed with the things that I'm hearing, and I had no idea, and I don't think maybe even not even a handful of our listeners had any idea about this mobility center in Illinois that controls all that activity or possible activity in sending these airplanes and weapons and troops and equipment in such a short time. Just amazing. So we did upgrade with the KC-46A Pegasus, which is really great, great, great. And I wanted to talk about very quickly the SR-71. By the way, folks, it just happened to be, it was RS-71. And when Lyndon Johnson went to make the announcement about the SR-71, he got it was the RS-70. He got it all backwards, folks, and he said SR-7. Now, is that a big deal with you? Don't tell the president that he got it wrong. And so it stuck, the SR-71, which to me was a stopgap from the U-2 to where now we have satellites. We have satellites doing the work of the SR-71. Is that what happened to the SR-71?
Well, it had a terrific career. It served for many, many years, right up until, I believe, about 1993. So it did a great deal of work over the old former Soviet Union. It did work during the Vietnam War. And I think they were proud of that unique designation, SR-71. The men who flew the SR, as they like to call it, were very, very hand-picked, great bunch. You would have a pilot and a sensor operator, so crew of two. Tremendous guys, incredible bond between them. They also, the other nickname for the SR was the Habu, so because of its really unique look. And, you know, these folks would talk about having to slow down, you know, literally hundreds of miles before they had to make a turn because the speed was so fast. It was a Mach 3 plus airplane, still a completely unique achievement. As far as its mission was responsive intelligence, ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. So responsive ISR. You could send the SR out to right where you needed it. Did you want to patrol along the Soviet border in the Pacific? Did you need to fly more along Europe, a mission in the Vietnam area during that war? You send it where you need to, collect the data, and bring it right back and download it off that jet and start to process it in. So the satellites in those days, sometimes you had to wait longer for the satellite to make the pass. We have much more extensive coverage now. But for the decades that the SR flew, it was the premier reconnaissance asset and an incredible aircraft, unbelievable crews, and they did amazing work.
And folks, this was right. The idea was not to get shot down like the U-2 was. So in order to do that, they had to go pretty darn fast, right? Right. And they were right on the edge of space, so they were high altitude, going fast, doing recon. Must have drove the Russians crazy. How about that?
Oh, I think it did. I think it did. And that alone would be a reason to bring a few back and drive Putin crazy again with the SR. That would be fun to do. But it was such a sophisticated aircraft, you know, designed and flew first in the 1960s. It came into service in the mid-60s. But very unique. It had its own type of fuel. It had unique systems for the pilots to be able to wear pressure suits because at those high altitudes, if they were to lose pressure, your blood literally boils. So they had to wear special pressure suits to do that. And the speed, just incredible to overcome that barrier and to have the efficiency and the speed. It also had some early stealth characteristics to make it harder to detect with radar. But its main defense was, of course, its Mach 3.2 plus speed and its service ceiling, which was 85,000 feet. That's space, essentially.
I would think so, folks. And it flew so fast that the skin of the aircraft would it shrink or expand? I forgot now. Oh, darn it. And that's why when it was on the ground, static, not moving at all, it would leak.
That's right.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, that's interesting stuff, Dr. Grant. That's really great. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, that's the pressure that you get at those speeds and then the heat as well. And, in fact, you know, aircraft like that tend to have a limit, you know, to which for how long can you fly before you start to get a type of melting effect and that expansion of the material. And then also, the other unique thing about the SR was that it was efficient, relatively speaking. It was able to, you know, take off under its own steam and climb through that subsonic regime, achieve supersonic flight, handle the shockwave ingestion through its engines, and do so on long missions. So it was relatively efficient as well, truly miraculously hit the sweet spot of aircraft design and the brainchild of one man, Kelly Johnson, who ran the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. It was Lockheed at the time, and a genius, just a genius. And it was really his idea. He did it.
And it was replaced by super satellites now made the aircraft obsolete. We can literally read the dial on your watch from space with some of these satellites and cameras and things that they have. Well, we're getting down to the end of the program, and I'm just about I'm looking around here, and what else do I have? I got something here to see. Dr. Grant, about scramjet? No, we don't. Do we want to talk about scramjet?
I think we want to come back and talk about the changes for women in the military.
Just let's do that.
To wrap up on that? Yeah. I think you've noticed that. And, you know, the fact is we've had women serving in probably 97% of the specialties for a long time. And so what Congress has said and the Army and Marine Corps chiefs of staff have said, that's right, let's open everything up. The women will compete on equal footing with men for those last few specialties where they're not included at the moment. They're not going to lower the standards, but they're going to let those women who qualify go ahead and do it. And I think women will register for the draft. To me, that's kind of a non-event. I'm in favor of having them register. But we know we have a volunteer force, and that's the core of our U.S. military right now, is that volunteer force. So, sure, let's open up the registration. That seems fair. But remember, we really are looking for a volunteer force. And so those women who can now seek out those specialties that were closed to them before, good for them. I know they're women who can handle those jobs, and I want to see them have the opportunity to compete for them.
Wow. That was quite 55 minutes, folks. It's a marathon. Dr. Grant, we always, always, always want to thank you for coming on and sharing with us and getting down to the real root and the real essence of some of these issues. You certainly are very knowledgeable. You certainly come and give a lot of information to our listeners. You are very popular. We want to say thank you. Please, please come back and visit with us again. Dr. Grant, have a great day. Are you still
there?
Thank
you. I'm so proud of our armed forces and our veterans, and I love to talk about the things you all have done. Thank you.
Wow. Well, we'll be right. What do we got? 10, 9. All right. Next week, we're going to be talking about grit. Right. Once again, grit. Bob Gould, you're dismissed.